You know, this time of year, it's not too surprising that the occasional insect will appear inside your house, sometimes seemingly out of nowhere. I've had that happen to me. Maybe it's happened to you, and you may have some questions about that. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, headed the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab for a long, long time, comes by pretty often to talk with you and with me about insects, and I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Call us at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, and if you have a photo of an insect, you post it up on our Facebook page. We'd love to see it. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And again, certainly love to have those photos come up. And Phil, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
We have, you know, there's lots of things we can talk about. Right off the bat, Kate in Lake Mills couldn't stay with us, but says she has a lot of, she calls them stink bugs in her house. Mm-hmm. Lots of them. She wants to know how to get rid of them, I guess.
Sure. Well, I can assure her that what happened is these stinkers came in the fall, and they were in her walls or attic and woke up. But what I'm a little curious about here, I can think of two possibilities, and one of them is going to be
one
more
of
a concern, at least to me as an entomologist. So what I would suggest that she go on the internet and look for an animal called the Western Conifer Seed Bug. This is an insect that feeds on pine in spruce cones, and it comes in, and if you bother it, it has a distinct odor.
So Western
conifer seed bug.
Seed bug, okay.
And those have been found in the state for about 15 years and really are not that much of a concern. The one that I would be somewhat more interested in, and so would PJ, at least who's running the diagnostic lab now, is out east there has been a significant problem with an animal we call the brown marmorated stink bug.
Mm.
And it is a little bit more shield-shaped. Not quite as elongated as the conifer seed bug. And we have had a trickling of those in here, meaning that we've got maybe five or six counties we've seen records, but we're only talking three or four. Whereas if you read about this insect out east, it comes into people's houses by the thousands. And we're really quite concerned because aside from the nuisance value, it has significant agricultural crop damage to both fruits and vegetables. And so we've been kind of monitoring it. And as I said, we have yet to have people overrun with it in this state. So this would be somewhat of concern. She can always ship a picture either to myself or to PJ. Mm-hmm. You know, she can take just a quick JPEG of it, and we can tell very quickly. But you can also just look up on it. Now, going back to what's going on, as I said, this time of the year, it doesn't pay to spray, set off bombs, because they're in the walls, you know, and you can't get in there. What we usually suggest for these kind of problems is try to identify where they're sneaking in and get it caulked or sealed or screened. And so you have to check your overhangs and your vents and those kind of things. So it's more of a physical adjustment, whatever shows up now, whether you use a vacuum cleaner or, you know, just hand remove them. That's all really you can do. You can try spraying with soapy water, but these insects are thick enough skin that soap sprays really aren't near as effective as it is against things like box elder bugs and some of the softer skinned insects.
Well, that's one of the questions we have. We have many more here. I know that, you know, this time of the year, for some people, it's kind of surprising to see bugs in the house, but sometimes they'll come in on firewood. You know, it's...
Yeah, well, you know, right now, if you think about today, at least when I walked in, it was sunny enough, and, you know, you get on the south side of the house, and your walls are warming up to the point that if things were sleeping in there, they will start to wake up. Now, one of the things that I would always get about this time of the year on these kind of days is people start finding ants. And in particular, if they're relatively large black ants, they were surprised when we tell them they're carpenter ants. And what this suggests, aside from they have to be nesting in the house, is they're probably nesting away from an outside wall because...
Too cold.
And right now, they're only looking for water. So you might see them around the bathroom sink at night or maybe around the kitchen, and then they seem to disappear. As we've talked about so many times in the show, I mean, carpenter ant implies that they're going to eat your house, but these things don't eat wood for a living. They live in water-damaged wood and styrofoam and other soft substrates. So you kind of keep your eyes open. There are ways to bait them a little bit later in the season when they really start looking for true food to feed their young. There's also some sprays that have come on the market in the last 8 to 10 years that have been very effective, although typically you have to get a pest control service to put these products on. They spray the outside of the house in the spring, and these 100% effective if it's done correctly, because the ants have to crawl through it to go out to look for food.
Sure.
And so, you know, things have kind of changed. Carpenter ants have gotten easier to control in the last few years because of some of these treatments.
I mentioned at the start of the show that there's more coming out about a Zika virus.
Right. Yeah, boy, this is especially the last 4 or 5 weeks the CDC has been making comments. And I think from a Wisconsin perspective, what you have to keep in mind here is the mosquitoes that are capable of transmitting this disease are not found in our state. This is basically a tropical problem. And the mosquito Aedes aegypti, which spreads yellow fever and dengue virus now, is apparently the principal vector of this. The other critter that gets kind of close, like southern Illinois, is the Asian tiger mosquito. That's more prevalent in the southeast. So we have a number of species in this genus in our state, but as far as we know, they are not capable of vectoring this disease. And so for people travel, especially young women who potentially are expectant moms, that's where I think the biggest concern is. You know, old guys like me, you know, you can potentially get, you know, a fever and a rash and feel down for a bit, but many people don't even show those symptoms. And so this is just another one of those cases of a virus that was somewhat regionalized and has now started to spread throughout the world. And so what's also a little unique about this is many other things, like West Nile have a bird host and the like. This seems to just be in humans and monkeys. And so the mosquito has to acquire it from somebody that's infected. And then when the mosquito goes to feed the next time, that's how it transmits the virus.
We have lots of questions. You can join in, by the way, if you want to, at 1-800-642-1234. Email that talk at WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. There's Chris from Wisconsin Dells wonders about this weather and if the weather we've had this winter will result in reduced tick populations in the coming year.
No, not even. I mean... In this hopes, whether it's insects or ticks, I find that winter weather really has very little effect on things. The one caveat I would give to that is if we had minus 35 below and no snow on the ground, then I can see potentially an impact. But these things are so well insulated that I don't find the winter has an effect on populations. As I've always said, that you know, if you ask me to make a prediction on things, I want to see what happens in the spring. And typically, if you wake things up and then slam the door, there's more of a potential to reduce populations. But I'll tell you, with ticks, I mean, you can take a tick and throw the stinker in a freezer for 12 hours and pull it back out, and it'll warm up and walk away. I mean, they really can adapt very quickly and shut their systems down. They don't freeze solid, which, you know, would hurt our tissue. That doesn't faze them. So, yeah, ticks have a two-year life cycle. What we find has the biggest impact is serious drought in the summer. Then they seem to have high mortality, but anything other than that, I just don't see climate factors really affecting much, other than we have seen this change with the lack of really cold weather that now we have the Lone Star tick, which is considered a southern tick, established in breeding in our population. That didn't exist when I started in the lab back in the late 70s. You know, that's a phenomenon we think of the last 10 years or so.
And the Lone Star tick is a concern because of?
It can transmit. It doesn't transmit Lyme, but it does transmit a couple other diseases. But the interesting one is that it has been found that certain individuals who are bitten by this tick develop a meat allergy. They can't eat red meat.
Oh, that's right.
And
I'd
so it's really
that.
Kind of an odd, antibody response in the like in people, but it's quite unique. And, you know, typically this was a tick that you'd have to be in southern Illinois, Missouri, or elsewhere to have any exposure with it. And now, as I said, Susan Paskowitz in our department and her students have been working with this. And, you know, pretty much we have found all the life stages here, so we know it's breeding.
Todd wonders, actually saw a walking stick on the side of his garage, and this was just last year. he lives in a rural area, and he hadn't seen one since he was, you know, like for 40 years. Mm-hmm. Have they always been around? Are they elusive, or
yes.
has their environment or habitat changed?
Most of the walking stick species that we have here, and we only have a handful, feed on oak trees, so we got plenty of food.
Yeah.
What you find is their populations really do fluctuate, and every once in a while you get an explosion to the point that they can defoliate an oak forest in the summer.
Wow.
And, you know, people talk about, it sounds like it's raining as their frass, which is the name we give their waste as it hits the ground. So they're there, but they're really quite, you know, they're so slow moving and so well camouflaged, unless they are standing next to something of a high contrast that you can pick it up. You know, most people don't see them. And, and as I said, you basically have to be out in the woods and crawling around and seeing what's going on in the leaf litter to find them. The other walking stick that I found very a delight to see, I'm in the process of trying to get this book written, which is coming slower than I was anticipating. But, you know, so it always brings up stories. And I received a picture of a walking stick that was found in Devil's Lake, supposedly. And this thing is about 3 inches long, and it has a red stripe down its about half of its back. And the first thing I thought as a graduate student was seeing if they were going to have some fun with me. But it turns out that we have a small population of the giant walking stick in the Devil's Lake area. Now, again, the normal range of that thing is down in Missouri and southward. Hmm. I had no idea that we had records of this, but when we went up to our museum at the department, sure enough, we had. Yeah. But it's a very localized population, so... sometime if you're walking in Devil's Lake in the summer, you might be like enough to see it. And again, it will be 2 to 3 times larger than any walking stick you've ever seen in the state, as the name giant walking stick implies.
Very, very cool. You know, as you were talking about that, I thought, you know, a camper, somebody who's, say, camping in across the country might well bring something like that that we don't normally see from one camping spot to another.
Well, you know, we're pretty sure that that's how gypsy moth got in the state. You know, gypsy moth does not fly, but it lays its eggs on everything from an outdoor furniture to somebody's camper. And, you know, the original gypsy moth population got started up in Door County. And when you think about it, it would make a whole lot of sense that somebody was traveling from out east with their camper, you know, for spending a few days up there. And that's how we got the transfer. So, yes, that definitely does happen. And as he said, firewood, it's a big no-no, as we all know now with emerald ash borer, is to transport firewood from one state to the next is always risking potentially bringing some critters here we don't want.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, as we talk the world of insects with him. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. It'll open lines and get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org and post a question on our Facebook page, and also a photo. Love the insect photos as well. On our Facebook page title, The Larry Mehler Show. And I'm Larry Mehler. Breanne Chesso, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Something kind of unpredictable is whether or not you're going to see any insects in your house this winter. And if you have, hey, Phil Pelletieri is the guy. He's with me right now. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Chuck in Lake Delton up next. Chuck, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. Say, this year we had a really, really heavy concentration of the western conifer seed bug. You know, I mean, heavier than I've seen it, you know, forever. I mean, they were all over the place this year. Is there something you think going on, or is it just one of them years?
And that's at the Lake Delton area.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, it's an insect that I didn't see when I started, and when we started getting the first records, as the name implies, it's found out in California and elsewhere. But this has been a phenomenon that's seen throughout the eastern half of the U.S. in the last 20 years. And so, relatively speaking, they weren't here when I was a kid. They're here now. But their populations will go up and down, although typically when I see somebody that's having a lot of problems and you ask, are they living in a pine woods or have lots of trees close by, and there's usually that relationship, one can speculate that it may be associated with the years that we have a lot of pine cones present, because that means lots of food. The other thing that these kind of insects typically do better in somewhat dry years just because there's a natural fungus disease that it seems to be more prevalent when things are very, very damp. So, you can get these localized things, but I have seen nothing to indicate that they are in plague numbers throughout the state this year.
There we go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. Betty in Rhinelander, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What have you got for us today?
A little menace in my household for the third winter.
Oh.
It resembles a fruit fly, but a little larger. Does not bother anything but some fruits. It is around. It does not like dark. It will not go under things, but it will go on top of things and invite all its friends by. And
so it looks like a fly?
It looks like a fruit fly, but a little larger.
Does most of the things, critters, show up in the kitchen around fruit, or do you see them everywhere?
Most of the time, but sometimes it migrates to the bathrooms, living room. It does not like to be on people. It's very flighty. It does not go under things.
Okay.
It goes on top.
Well, you know, the problem is when you talk about something the size of a fruit fly in the house, there's three answers I could give people.
Yes.
True fruit flies, yes. I mean, the thing that people tend to not recognize is fruit flies have to breed on things that are high in yeast and have moisture. So you do associate them with overly ripe fruit, but it's so ripe where they're really breeding is you'd never eat it. I mean, we're talking puddles of things.
Yeah.
But I've seen them in jars that are not washed out sufficiently and the like. I've seen them in decaying bulbs that people bring in for the winter. Now, the other two critters, there is a critter we call a sewer or forid fly that will breed in drains in particular that have organic matter. And so it's far more decayed stuff than fruit flies will mess with. And they're about the size and shape of fruit flies. And then the third one are fungus gnats, which mostly are a little bit more fragile or frail body structure. But I think this is well worth, if you can get a couple, three, and get it in the local extension office, and sometimes the agents there can identify it. If not, they'll send it down to PJ just to be sure. Because it's one of these things, if you know what the critter is, then you know what you need to hunt for to clean up. And it's not something you normally would spray for. It's something you deal with the breeding site and get it cleaned up, and then things should be fine. It is interesting that it's been reoccurring in three winters in a row. So.
Right. Yeah. I brought it in, and I have contacted you people before, and they said when summer comes, it goes outside, which seems to be true.
Oh, you don't see it at all in the summer. It's only in the winter.
Well, I can't think of any little gnat-like creatures, you know, because what that suggests is one of these creatures that are, you know, spending the winter rent-free, coming in the fall and leaving. But those are usually bigger things like cluster flies and box elder bugs and ladybugs and that kind of thing. So as I said, it might be worth just another follow-up on this and
collect
said,
some.
Get the exact name for it, and then I think things will get easier to deal with.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And it's the Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Yes.
University of Wisconsin-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Right, 1630 Linden Drive.
Yeah.
And the university zip is 53706.
There you go, Betty. Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Kathy in Wind Lake. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just have a question about all of these box elder bugs that are in. They're driving us crazy. It seems like this winter, my husband kills three or four a day sometimes. And where are they coming from, first of all, and how can I get rid of them?
Sure. So this is one of those cases that they're coming out of your walls or your attic space, and if you wake up each day, I can assure you they're not breeding there, and I can also guarantee you that this all, you lost the war in September. Because, you know, what they will do is congregate on the sunny sides of buildings and then, you know, kind of squeeze into wherever they can. And, you know, hopefully they're in a rock pile or something outside. That's how they would get through the winter. In the spring, when it warms up, they wake up. So the problem is that there really is no magic. I mean, you can have somebody come and spray your house right now, and you're not going to gain on them because you really cannot get access to those wall voids and attic spaces that they come from.
Okay.
So other than just kind of tolerate, so your defense has got to be more on what you can do during the spring or summer to find out where they're sneaking in caulk or seal. If that doesn't work, sometimes when we say this and somebody's got an old farmhouse that is just no way you can tighten up, there are sprays that can be applied to the outside of the structure in September. And basically you have to kill them before they get through. And that's what they do, is when they land on the side and start crawling around, they will die. And, you can buy some of these at the hardware store, or you can have them professionally applied. It's really the timing. And as I said, if you don't stop them in September, you're not going to stop them.
All right. Well, that's good to know. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And just went to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and Chris has got a really cool photo of a cicada coming out of its shell, which is really nice, isn't it?
So this is the dog day cicada, which is usually starts to sing in the end of July and August. We have at least a couple species in the state, and they do have somewhat different songs. And they have a 2 to 3 year life cycle in most cases, but they're some out every year. So sometimes people get confused because they know about the 17-year cicada, which we've only got one population, and it's going to be a while before they come again. But you can find these, as they said, every year, and they're just neat creatures. A lot of people don't realize that this is the thing that's singing. This is such a buggy-eyed looking insect, and they wonder what the devil it is. But that's a cicada nymph, and they have to come crawling out of the ground, and then their skin splits, and the adult comes out. That's what we're seeing right here. And in a matter of a few hours, those wings will expand, harden, and then they can fly away.
That's a really cool photo. Jeff and Mary sent us a pretty good shot of an ichneumon wasps. Yeah. Ichneumon?
I'm looking a little close because I'm trying to pick up. Oh, now I see it. Okay, I was looking at the twigs and wasn't seeing what it is. So this one...
it's a pretty cool shot, too.
The genus name is Megarissa. It does not have a common name. It belongs to the ichneumonid family, of which there are hundreds of species. But this one's quite unique in that Megarissa has this great big long egg-laying device that's 2 to 3 inches long. It drills it into wood. That's what's going on now.
Oh, here's another shot of it.
Inside that wood is something that we call a horntail, which is the grub of a sawfly-like creature. And these are parasites of that. So it drills in, lays its egg, and then its egg hatches in the larvae of the other insect and kills it. They look scary, but they're totally harmless. And again, how they can devise getting this very, what appears to be almost thread-like thin device and drill 2 to 3 inches deep in wood. I probably see them on maple more than anything else, but you can find them on a number of different trees. So,
some pretty cool photos. If you have a chance, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Over on the left side, there's a category called Posts to the Page. Click on that, and these photos will come up. And we'll probably be getting some more as well. So in the meantime, I really like those photos. Dave in Madison, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Just to follow up on the box elder beetle problem, every September, even August, I get what looks like Woodstock box elder beetle on my front wall, and they're there warming and whatnot. And from what I got from you, you said to attack the problem then, but I don't want to use an insecticide. Is there something, I don't know, water that I can address that with?
You know, the soap thing is very effective, but you got to have to be a little careful, and this goes way back on this show. One of my old recipes was from a colleague down at Iowa State that we used a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water. And we had a caller call in and tried Cheer, and it didn't work. And so I'm scratching my head. But it turns out that soap chemistries differ. So if you're going to kill them with soap, what I have the most faith is to go to the local plant store and buy insecticidal soap. We know what's in there. It's the right stuff. It's a great contact kill. The one dilemma with soaps is that if you spray the side of the house and they show up 2 hours later, it's not going to kill them. So you have to get them when they're congregated, whereas, some of the other residual sprays will last for a couple weeks. But the soaps are very effective. And if you want to use home soaps, my concern is, first of all, I'm not sure what's in there. Secondly, you got to be a little careful with the concentration, because if you put too heavy a soap load in there, you will burn some of your green plants. And then there's also, you know, perfumes and dyes and other things in there that may or may not be phytotoxic. So, as I said, I have the most faith that the insecticidal soap that's sold is the right stuff, doesn't have any other impurities, and they'll give you the concentrations. It's usually a 1% or 2% solution. It's not that concentrated that is very effective.
And, of course, the other, I think, is almost impossible is to tighten the house up so that they can't get in, and that's a hard thing to do.
Well, you know, it depends. In a lot of new houses, people will say, you know, I see a whole bunch outside, but I rarely see them inside. And what you find is a lot of times they're using house wraps like Tyvek and other types of products that the critters can get underneath the siding. So you lift the siding up, and it says loaded with box elder bugs, but there's no way they can penetrate through the wall to get into your house. But the problem is so often that even in new houses, it's the overhangs are sometimes constructed that there are places things can squeeze through. And the argument is once they get into those walls, they can show up anywhere. They come down through your light fixtures, through your electrical outlets.
Yeah.
And as I say, that's where the frustration gets. And you know, sometimes it's worth, if you can get in the attic, look in there and see. Surprisingly, you find that some attics, they have vent systems, but they never screen the vents. And so you got a hole, you know, 6 inches wide in your attic that, you know, the insects have an easy time to get into. So they said sometimes you get lucky and just a single adjustment about, you know, tacking a little bit of screen on one of these vents and they go away.
Dave, thanks again. Let's go to Dave in Rothschild next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I just have a quick question and a related comment. And this relates back to when I was a kid 40 years ago, and I'm over 50 now. Once I saw a garden spider, and if it really was, you know, I believe they're like yellow and black, and I thought, yep. God, that this doesn't look like it should be this far north. And related to that, as you'd mentioned, that walking sticks were seen in Devil's Lake, and that's way too far north of their territory. Well, at the same time, when I was a kid over 40 years ago, I had seen walking sticks all the time, and I was raised just outside of Wisconsin Rapids, and there was a hardwoods near our house that we would play in, and we'd find them, and then we'd take them out and, I guess, tease them, because mm-hmm. you know, they're fascinating to us, but yeah. We saw walking sticks all the time.
Yeah, no, see, that's the species. We have walking sticks that are found throughout the state. The one I was speaking of in Devil's Lake is a very unique one. It's much bigger, and as I said, the one distinctive thing, it's got this big red line down it. So that's the giant walking stick. That's very localized, but the ones you saw are the common ones that we see. And as I said, as far as I'm aware, we have three species that you could run into the state, although one is by far the most common. And typically, oak woods is where I would expect to go find it.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, very interesting. Yeah,
now, the spider thing. We have two species of black and yellow garden spiders. The genuses are GOP, and they are very common in the late summer, make great photographic subjects. And they belong to a family that we call the orb weavers, which have a whole bunch of very neat, colorful spiders. You know, the abdomens are usually marble-shaped. It can be bright orange, bright red with cream markings and other things. And then, again, the RGOP, which is classically jet black with bright yellow striping on it.
With pretty cool webs.
Yes. Yes. Really? Especially if you can get a little bit of dew that kind of highlights
yeah,
the webs.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Dave, thanks. Appreciate the call. Want to give Laura in Arpen a chance to join in. Laura, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
In early January, all of a sudden we discovered ants, and I contacted the insect diagnostics lab, and they recommended baits. But before I could get those baits through mail order, I just put down, you know, the borax-based stuff that you can buy at the hardware store. And I saw the ants using that all of the time, going in and getting the bait and, you know, I knew what was going on. But now that I've put those two other carpenter ant baits, there's one that's kind of a gel, and I think that's supposed to be the sugar-based, and then one that's like pellets, which I think is supposed to be protein-based.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the ants using those stations at all.
Sure.
And so I was wondering, do you think that we have the identification wrong? Should I just be using those taro baits? Or are they likely using it and I'm just not seeing them?
Sure. You still have a good chance the baits will work. Typically, I find this early activity, the ants, again, seem to be more looking for a liquid than they do food. And for that reason, baits don't work. And so baits, to me, are seasonal. And the best time to use them is in the spring when the all of a sudden the ants are starting to raise young. They have this big food demand. We know that the baits are less effective once we get into July and August because the ants don't have that much food. Plus, there's so much more food competition. So I think it will work. The thing about using baits at any time is bait acceptance. And so if you were getting that much activity out of the borax-based baits, I would still keep using them. But in order to be effective, it's a combination of how much baits they take and how many ants are back in the colony. But the most important aspect is that the ant that we have to kill is the queen. And carpenter ants, unlike honeybees, if you kill the queen, they have no way of recovering. And so that's the secret and why baits are effective. What's quite interesting biologically is it seems that carpenter ants are very careful when they bring new food sources in. So the queen does not necessarily see the baits right away, which is kind of a safety precaution biologically because they can't afford to lose her. And at times it seems you get a whole bunch of activity and then they seem to lose interest. It's almost, you know, you can't give them human qualities, but it's almost as if they learn that there's something hazardous here. But so I would keep going with it. And as I said, with the other baits that you bought, I would just be patient and expect that if the ants are still active, there's a good chance they'll start picking it up in March, April, and May. And that's, you know, if the borates didn't do it, these new baits will. And the reason we recommend those kind of specialized baits is they are formulated, the research was done, that they are highly attractive to the ants, whereas the borax and sugar type baits, it's kind of hot and cold has been my experience. The ants can be real excited one day and not the next, but I think you're going the right direction. They said just give it some time.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. With the queen, what is it? Is it just the queen is producing more ants all the time?
She's the only one she's the only one capable of reproducing.
Okay.
And so all the other ants are sterile females, and she is the one member of the colony. And it's really intriguing because it has to do with her diet when she was raised. That makes her a queen, kind of like it works in honeybees, too. Each queen starts the nest from scratch. So everybody in there is her offspring, and again, pretty much all her daughters, because that's what the workers are. When the colonies get to be 3 to 4 years old and are successful, then they will start producing new queens and males for the first time. Those are the winged ants that swarm, and they leave. Everybody goes and starts new colonies elsewhere rather than staying. Now, that's the pattern for our native ants. What we call tramp ants, which are typically exotic ants that are getting here, poses a whole different problem because usually they have multiple queens and multiple colonies. So things like pavement ants and whatnot are far more difficult to wrestle with because you can kill 20 queens and you still might have another 40 that you're going to have to deal with. So it's like a mega colony that potentially can go on. So they are always more challenging, although, again, the baits have, in general, if you can match the bait with the ant you're dealing with, the most successful way of dealing with these.
Back to Facebook for a minute. Gary sent us a photo of white margin burl bug nymphs in the garden. They're pretty cool looking.
Yeah, and he did a good
orange
job of identifying
black.
It because, you know, there's a number of stink bugs and whatnot that the nymphs look quite similar, and there's three or four families of true bugs that, as I said, you got to do a little homework to identify. But, you know, typical sucking mouth parts. And again, they make great photographic subjects. I just love those kind of pictures.
Yeah,
you make calendars out of that stuff.
Yeah, really, really, really cool. Patricia in Madison, thanks a lot for calling.
Good morning, Larry and Phil. I don't have anything exotic, but I've had a lot of these orange Asian ladybugs in my house this winter. Not a great amount, but enough that it bothers me. And they seem to migrate to the very top of my southern and western facing windows. And I've been picking them off and throwing them outside. Am I doing something bad?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because in general, you know, most people are very tolerant of lady beetles except this species. And the problem with this one is they do invade houses. They also will take a nip out of you in the fall. And if you touch them, they will often secrete this kind of strong smelling and even staining liquid, which is kind of a defense mechanism. So What's quite interesting is that the ones that wake up are probably not going to live very long anyway, because they don't have a whole lot of stored energy reserves. So whether you were to throw them outside or not, I don't think the ones that have become active have much of a chance of surviving. Now, the other side that's really kind of interesting about this species is that we know that adults can live upwards of 2 to 3 years. So they're extremely long-lived in some cases compared to your average insect. And one can only guess that, you know, a small percentage of what snuck in your house is becoming active, and that the ones that do survive the winter will wake up in April and fly away, and you won't even see them and stuff. So I'm kind of neutral as far as what you do with them, you know. If you are trying to get them to survive, you're probably better to put them in some kind of little plastic container and put them out in the garage where it is going to be cold enough that they will not be active, but you haven't made this drastic change from 65 degrees and, you know, reasonable, and they've woken up to, you know, minus two outside. That, you know, it's the shock that typically kills insects, as I said. So if you're trying to get them, you put them in a place, cool them down a little bit slower, and then they probably will survive. You could even, if you wanted to, put them in a container, you know, with a little bit of tissue in your refrigerator, you know, and again, cool them down, keep them cold, and then in the spring when things finally warm up for good, open it up and let them disperse.
There you go.
Are they beneficial?
Well, they eat aphids.
Oh, okay.
And other, you know, lady beetles are generalist predators, and so they feed on a wide variety of things. There's even been a paper where they, unfortunately, will feed on very small monarch caterpillars, among other things. But, you know, that's not their main diet. Their main diet is aphids. And, you know, whether it's aphids in soybean fields or aphids on people's pine trees and the like, they do feed on that. But the argument is if they were not here, we have a number of native species that do the same thing. And one of the concerns about this species is that they have displaced, they've pushed out some of our native species or reduced their numbers dramatically. So in general, we wish this insect wasn't here.
Yeah,
it's kind
there
of
you go.
Probably a way of putting it.
Thanks, Patricia. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. And we have lots of callers online. Wayne in Appleton has been waiting a bit, so let's go to Wayne. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Hi, Phil. I'm a big fan of yours, and you've emailed over a period of time. But that being said, it seems like a lot of your callers are trying to get rid of bugs, and I want more of them. Of course, I don't want bed bugs, but I want more bugs. And I've been seeing in the city a drastic decrease in the amount of insects in my area. And I know that's due to pesticides. And but I do want to buy the online egg sacks where I can buy praying mantises. And I want to introduce them into my garden to control some of the other insects that I have a problem with, mainly whiteflies. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
A couple things. Interesting enough, in the last 10 years or so, we have kind of convinced ourselves that we have naturally breeding populations of mantids, especially in the southern third of the state and also up in Door County. Now, the two species are the European mantid and the Asian mantid, which are both non-natives. And the reason that they are now breeding here is that it appears the winters are mild enough to allow the egg cases to survive. Now, if you want to promote that, if you can get some egg cases and you do occasionally see them in gardening catalogs, and you may be able to find them online, is they'll ship them to you, and I would leave them in the refrigerator so that they don't develop until it finally starts to get green leaf tissue and things are growing, and then you can take it outside and just let it go natural. They will hatch when things warm up, and there's only one generation a year. The one thing about their feeding patterns, though, is I don't think they're going to help you as much on white flies as they would bigger things like grasshoppers and the like. Their diet, as they get bigger, is demanding larger insects. So they'll feed on moths and bees and butterflies and whatnot as they're bigger nymphs and adults, and won't really concentrate on small things like white flies. And so if you really had a whitefly problem and you want to control them biologically, again, if you go on the internet in some of these biological control houses, they have specific parasites that they will sell you. And these are little tiny, tiny wasps. In all, they don't sting people, but they lay their eggs inside whiteflies and kill them. And they do use this in the greenhouse industry to control whiteflies indoors. And so that, if you're looking for a biological control of whiteflies, that would be the direction I would go. On the other hand, there's nothing wrong with raising mantids. I think it's just, you know, especially you got kids in the neighborhood, they are just neat creatures for kids to see. And, you know, once you learn about mantids, you never forget.
Yeah, absolutely. Wayne, thank you very much for calling. Kind of an interesting photo up on our Facebook page right now. Jerry and Joan sent this photo.
Tiger swallowtail.
They found the butterfly on the windowsill in the living room yesterday.
Ah, okay.
Spent the night in the same place. It's still there this morning. They don't know what to do with it.
Okay, yeah, we got a minor problem with that. Unless you're lucky enough, you know, like we have the Obrick Gardens here, and I'm not sure Obrick would accept a butterfly, because they raise butterflies, and you know there's some disease issues. But if you've got a indoor tropical house in the area, the best chance for this thing surviving for at least a short term. Now, what probably happened is a chrysalis was brought into the house on firewood or on plants that you might have had out in the yard, and things now have warmed up enough that they think it's spring. So the unfortunate thing is we're 4 months away from the normal emergence of tiger swallowtails. And so, you know, the butterflies themselves are relatively short-lived, but this one's got a problem because it can't find a mate. And the butterflies, the tiger swallowtails in the northern part of the state breed on poplar, among other things, and there's no poplar leaves to lay eggs on, even if we did have a mating pair. So the unfortunate thing is it's not going to survive it, you know. You can make friends with it for a week or two, but it's as I said, it's really, no matter where you take it, it's not going to be successful in breeding.
Fritz in Mundelein, Illinois, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. During the summer, I have four or five big ant nests on my front yard, and so it kills all the grass in those areas. Do you have any suggestions?
Yes. So the type of ant I think you got are what we would call field ants, and they can make mounds that are, you know, 3 feet wide and 8 inches high, and with all the churning of the soil and whatnot, things don't grow. Now, the secret to controlling field ants is like the carpenter ants we talked about earlier. There's a single queen, but she is 2 to 3 feet deep in the ground. So what I have had the best success with is I'll usually go out there with a rake it a little bit, and what you're going to see is 3 or 4 main chambers the ants are bubbling out. Be a little careful because those things can bite you. It's not a bad bite, but, you know, who wants to be bit by critters? But what I do is take a steel rod, like a crowbar and the like, and I push down into those holes as far as I can, you know, hopefully 10, 12, 15 inches. Then almost any ant spray that you buy or you would get, but I prefer to get liquid stuff and, you know, put a teaspoon to a gallon of water and then pour it down those holes. And what I'm doing is I'm drenching it deep enough that it will get to the queen, or at least has a chance. If you just mix the stuff up and pour it on the top, it never soaks deep enough. And so people complain it doesn't kill the ants. Well, it's because you're not killing the one that you're after. And so, as I said, you spot treat each nest. If you want, you know, after you drench, you can take that soil that you know, kind of raked off, is rake it back on. And what you're doing then is capping it with untreated soil. So we're not exposing other things to insecticide. And so, as I said, I have found that to be very effective. Now, when people laugh at me is when they've got 10 acres and they've got, you know, 100 ant nests and I tell them the story, they're not real happy with me. But that's the only way I know how to get them.
There you go. Thanks, Fritz. Back to the Facebook page for a second. Tyrone sent us a really cool shot of
It's a katydid.
A daylily.
Right. So, you know, there's a family of green grasshoppers that to entomologists are the longhorn grasshoppers. And the katydids, and there's a few other species, the cone-nosed and cone-headed grasshoppers fit in this group. So the katydids are the ones that in usually August and September, you'll hear this interesting rattle in a tree. In fact, usually you'll hear a rattle in this tree, and then 6 trees over, there's something answering it. And those are the katydid males making the sound. And so they're neat creatures. They, you know, are plant feeders as adults, but there's never enough katydids to cause any damage, so we don't consider them any kind of pest other than, you know, I have had people complain about being kept awake at night when the katydids are out there calling. But other than that, and as I said, they're neat. And I have one picture in my file that was sent to me of a pink one.
Oh.
I mean, absolute pink. And when it was first shipped to me, I was sure that this was taken in the tropics because I've seen pictures. But it turns out that even some of our native katydids have a very small segment of the population that occurs occasionally that is bright pink. And
wow.
So if you ever get lucky enough to see one of those, I said, that is
photo
really
of that.
Something. It looks more like something out of a science fiction movie than what you'd expect in Wisconsin.
Well, this photo is really nice because it's that bright green katydid against that bright yellow fragrant returns daylily,
right.
Which is really a nice photo.
And one would wonder if he's feeding on some pollen. You know, pollen is such a great food source for insects for protein. And so if I had to guess what he was hanging out there for, that's what it would be.
Luke in Galesville, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I was just wondering if your guest there could talk a little bit about the differences in identification between the green tiger beetles and the emerald ash borers. I see a lot of people in the summer killing tiger beetles thinking they're ash borers.
I guess, kind of expected because when you hear the name emerald ash borer, is really very descriptive of the coloration. But we have a number of bright green critters. Some of them are bees and the like. The emerald ash borer is a very, maybe about 10 millimeters long. So we're talking something, a little over a quarter inch or so. A very elongated and compact insect is the best way to describe it. I mean, you really can't see the legs very easy, the antennae very easy. Tiger beetles, on the other hand, you know, their legs are sitting way out. They're predators, and they have to go chase down their prey. And so, indeed, it's much easier to see their body parts to me, whether it's the antennae, the legs, even the head kind of sticks out more. The other thing is where you expect to find them. I mean, tiger beetles are usually running around on the ground looking for prey, flying out ahead of you. To be honest, the only place I would expect to see an emerald ash borer is on an ash tree, whether it's on the leaves or the trunk of the tree. And it's much easier, I think, to visually find a tiger beetle. With all the ash borer problems we have, honestly, we rarely see people that see the adults. They see the trees starting to die, and they pull back the bark, and they see the larvae. And so, as I said, that's if you see a bright green insect, the probability of it being an ash borer, I think, is pretty small.
Pretty low.
And tiger beetles is one of the more common bright green insects. It's also, most of our tiger beetles are quite a bit bigger. You know, they're just a more robust insect. They're longer, they're heavier. And as I said, their legs sit right back out, and they scurry is the best way. You know, when you see them run, or they can fly. They're really quite good at flying. Emerald ash borer, as I said, I if you're lucky enough to see one, it's just going to be kind of a flash, and it's going to be gone.
And the damage, how bad is it in the state? That was Dan in Richland County wondered about that.
Well, you know, it's been a disappointment, not an unexpected problem, but it takes time to build. So when you hear about the counties that have found positive infestations, you know, that affects where we quarantine and the like. But as far as seeing trees dying in front of your eyes, you know, it often takes a number of years in a given county for it to become prevalent enough that you can be driving down the highway and you see trees dying in the woods. And so that's, you know, so back in parts of the southeast, you know, just north of Milwaukee, which are some of the original areas, there's the tree mortality is quite visible. You know, we've had it in Dane County now for, I think, probably about 4 years. And,
yeah.
And I have not seen a tree myself that I knew was infested. Now, part of it in our city, where our city foresters are cutting trees and the like. But as I said, so that'd be a way of thinking. Up in Richland County, where things are just starting to trickle, as I said, it will be a number of years, I think, before it kind of slaps you in the face like Dutch elm disease does with all the dying elm trees that we see.
No. And Luke, again, thank you for calling. Heather in Eau Claire, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. So I have something of an insect phobia, and I've managed to kill two centipedes in my house. I understand that they eat other bugs, and now I've seen two smaller centipedes, and I'm wondering if by killing the centipedes, although they're terrifying, if I kill them, will I have a whole bunch of other unwanted insects?
Probably not. I mean, the thing about centipedes is they are slow to breed, and it's pretty slim pickings in most people's houses. I mean, there are some critters there, and you can tell because they are supporting a population, but it's a small population. And I don't see, you know, so if you can appreciate them for what they do, it's best to leave them alone. But if they're just too creepy to put up with, you know, I can understand to try to reduce the numbers. I think the best way to do that is with some of these sticky boards and the like. You know, so you don't spray, but these are just tacky cardboard paper. And you got to be careful you got pets and stuff because you don't want your cat to get associated with. But if you put this underneath tables, and in particular, I pay attention to my basement because centipedes prefer higher humidities. And often that's kind of place. But why I tell people you can never guarantee to get rid of all of them is I think at times they're spending a good portion of their time in your walls or your attic and you can't get to them there. But if they get out in the open, they get caught on with these sticky boards, it will kill them. And so it's a way of physically reducing the population without having to do sprays and the like. So yeah, you could leave them be. If you got could magically get rid of them, you will not be overrun with insects. I would not expect that.
No, there you go, Heather. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus for the University of Wisconsin-Madison at Extension and former head of the Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we'll be right back. Thanks so much for being with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. Entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus from the UW-Madison, the Insect Diagnostic Lab. It's always great to have him come by, and you can join in, 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Melissa in Eau Claire has a question for you, Phil. Melissa, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So every winter, we get this little moth in our house. It's maybe like a whitish or grayish, very small moth, and the wings move really, really fast, but the moth itself just kind of floats around. And we have no idea what it is or how to get rid of it. I was kind of hoping maybe you had some ideas on what it could be.
Well, you know, normally when I get the call, I associate moths that come out of pet food, birdseed, those kind of things. But I'm suspicious with this reoccurring and being seasonal. And to be honest, there's a couple very small moths that we have that are associated in the summer with being leaf miners on trees, meaning their little caterpillars cause these funny little swirly things in the leaves. But the adults overwinter as adults in sheltered sites, and they're small enough to get through screening and the like. And so I'm a little suspicious that it's one, that one in particular is on aspen, another one's on birch trees. This is one, though, I think to confirm that, it would be worth just sending some out down to PJ and let him take a peek at them just to be sure. And if that's the case, you know, the good news is they're harmless. The bad news is unless you remove the trees around the house, it probably is going to be a reoccurring problem. You know, and I have seen them, you know, in a windowsill a half inch deep. I mean, in certain years, they can be there by the thousands. But that's also the year you recognize that every leaf on the tree's got little trails in it. And so, as I said, that's not overly common. But I'm just suspicious from your description because, as I said, the other moths in the house are either associated with food or occasionally it could be clothes moths, although I'd say that's quite rare. And typically people are well aware not so much of the moths with clothes moths, but the damage that they see on woolens and feathers.
Yeah, we don't have any clothes damage or anything. It's just the smallest little moth, and it'll get right up in your face and everything. You know,
I really think, and in fact, the other thing is if you burn firewood, it's even possible that they're overwintering under the bark crevices and you're bringing them in and warming them up that way. But as I said, I'm leaning towards one of these overwintering adults of one of these little leaf tires or leaf miner moths.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And are you said I should send one in to you, or?
Yeah, well, okay, so you're up in Eau Claire, so you can bring them to the extension office there, and they can take a peek at them, and if they can't identify them, they send them down to the diagnostic lab, and as I said, then PJ can confirm, or they might even be able to just take a picture of them, because they are distinctive. They're very, very tiny, long, and skinny might be the best way to put what these leaf tire and leaf miner moths look like.
Well, these aren't very long or skinny. These are more... it's just a little tiny, it just looks like a little tiny...
Like a pencil eraser size?
You know what? Yeah. And you know what? It almost, when it sits down, it almost looks like a fly sitting there. But then when it, flies...
We're going a different direction now. So there is a beast that is called a moth fly. And it technically is a true fly. But because the hair's on their wings, and if you crush them, they leave powder. Now, moth flies are also called drain flies, and that's where they come from, is basement floor drains. I find them in the overflow cuts of bathroom sinks quite commonly. And what they need is an accumulation of organic matter, but not a lot of water, because if there's a lot of water going through the drain, they couldn't breed. They're pretty weak flyers.
They barely just float around.
Okay.
But their wings go really, really fast.
One of the things that you can consider is getting just a really hot pail of water and pour it down your basement floor drain.
Okay.
Any other drains that you might have that, as I said, sometimes in our house on the first floor, they used to have a washing machine in one of the closets. And so there's a floor drain there. It never sees any water. But that would be a place that I would put the hot water down if I was having a problem. The other place that you might want to try to clean as best you can is the overflow cut in your bathroom sink. That little space there that prevents the water from coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Is get in there with a brush or whatnot and just get that goop out as best you can. Because what you're doing is removing the organic matter that's supporting the maggots. And if there's no maggots, there's no flies.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you.
And again, I would look at it on the internet under drain fly just to see if what it looks. But that makes more sense. I'll be honest, we see them in our house typically late summer, early fall, and usually it tells me I better consider going out and getting the shower drain cleaned up because that kind of gets goopy, and that kind of goop is what supports them. Putting bleach down the drains doesn't work. All that does is sterilize the outside of the goop. So you got to break it down. In severe cases, and what they do in food handling establishments that have floor drains is they put a bacterial digester down to eat through that slimy sludge, and that prevents their kind of problems.
Thanks, Melissa. Appreciate the call. AJ and Dane, it's your turn. Hi, AJ.
Good afternoon, Larry.
Good afternoon.
We started bees again just recently at my grandfather's house, and we had two hives, and they made great honey. However, both hives did not make it, and we contacted the distributor, and he suggested wasps that had gotten in there, and we checked the hives, and sure enough, we had several large wasps in there, and all the bees did not make it. Any suggestions?
Well, I guess I hate to disagree, and I will tell you I don't consider myself a bee expert, but we do find when colonies get very weak that they can be robbed by wasps. So there is a relationship there. But to me, the important point is the colony's weak. If it was strong and healthy, they would not tolerate the wasps. They would drive them out. So it's an underlying fact that the colony was not doing well, and I'd be more inclined to start looking at whether it's bee diseases or varroa mite or other maladies that would weaken the colony enough to allow the wasps to get access. So that's to me what it says, is that the colony was not doing well, it was weakened out, and the wasp problem was an aftermath of that. And now the question is trying to unravel the mystery of why the colonies were so weak.
Yeah.
Oh.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, AJ, for calling. And Margie in Mount Horeb. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Bill and Larry. I have one question that I talked to your screener about, and then another one that I thought of that is relates to that and the mulch. I have a worm. It looks like an angleworm, but they're skinnier. And they climb up the house and the windows, and they're just all over. It's the first year we've ever had these things. And I was wondering if it was something called the jumping worm, and if possibly it came from the mulch, or if this is the worm that goes down and is going to destroy all of my flower beds. I have 37 flower beds.
Do the worms appear segmented at all?
Yes. There's okay. one. There's just one little, like a little fat section in the center. But other than that, no.
I mean, that it's sounds like a regular.
Yeah.
It looks like a regular angleworm, but really, really tiny. And they climb up the side of the house and up the windows. I mean, they're...
Yeah, see, that's what is concerning, although, you know, so how long do you think the critters are? Quarter inch?
2 inches.
2 inches long?
Yep, and they go from an inch to 2 inches long, yep.
Mm. Okay.
And then they dry up after they've been out for a while, and then they make these little skinny curly things all over everywhere.
See, yeah, the curly things, to be honest, is in where they're coming from is far more suggestive of millipedes. But millipedes, if you look closely, and you might need a little magnification, have just hundreds of little legs underneath.
Nope.
And they're made up of little rings. And, nope. And are they crunchy when they're dead?
I don't know. I haven't crunched them.
The only, because millipedes would be, because they've got this hard outer shell, whereas typical annelid worms, you know, the earthworm types don't. But little earthworm type things should dry up. Yep. What I'm fishing for a little bit here is that, you know, if they weren't so long, is I've got some larvae maggots of some of the flies that can be long and skinny and are extremely worm-like.
Mm-hmm.
They usually have a very well-defined little black head to them, though.
Nope.
And they would breed in decaying organic matter. Now, the jumping worm is you know, all our worms, honestly, are invasive, but the jumping worm is an Asian species that, as the name implies, it will jump when you see it on the soil and kind of wiggle around and stuff. But it, what I'm a little puzzled at is all the kind of earthworm type creatures I know don't want to come out of the ground. I mean, they're so sensitive to drying out and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
You would not
mm-hmm.
expect them to crawl unless things are so flooded that they can't breathe. And of course, that's when we see worms coming out of the ground.
And that's when we had all of the rain. That's when they'd come up and out.
Mm-hmm.
We had all of that rain this fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's
okay.
when they were up and out, and they were climbing. I have some up at the tip of the roof. You can spot them up there. I mean, I got my binoculars out to see what those little spots were, and they were dried up worms.
Wow.
Would you define that side of the house as being ultra shady and
east side?
East side. Oh,
yep.
Boy. You know, that again, if you see any activity, that'd be worth, in this case, because they're kind of soft-bodied, I'd throw them in rubbing alcohol or whatnot. But then get somebody to get a closer look. I honestly don't think it's a problem. Even if it is a classic type of earthworm, those things feed on organic matter. They're not going to hurt your plants. The argument, honestly, is they do beneficial things to the soil unless you get them out in the woods where, you know, again, being a non-native, they start doing things you don't want them to. But, it's just a little perplexing because, again, I've seen earthworms look for higher ground, but I've never seen them climb up to a two-story and hanging out up there. So, as I said, I'm not sure. I'd really like to know for sure what they were before we kind of figure out what's going on here.
And at least a photo.
Yes. Yes, a photo of a live one. And it sure sounds like when you talk about you seeing that very distinct segment in, you know, it's about a third of the way back that you see on most true annelid earthworms.
Yeah.
So.
Margie, thank you. Appreciate the call. Patty and Eden, it's your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I have a question. I have a garden with the kids at UW Fond du Lac. Every summer, we have a problem with a whole bunch of gray shield bugs. They're just solid. And
are they on the squashes and those kind of plants?
Squashes and pumpkins.
Okay, so what you've got is the squash bug.
So how do we prevent that?
Okay.
Every year.
Two ways. So they overwinter as adults.
Okay.
So as soon as you put the transplants out, you look to see if those devils show up. They're in the adult stage, they are up to an inch long and kind of a dark brown. So you can hand pick them. Or that's when you want to spray. If you see these clusters, they're very susceptible to soapy water spray. So you have to use anything very toxic.
So when do we do this spraying, though?
When you
in August?
When you see, no, well, there's two generations.
Okay.
So the first wave is probably rumbling out there in May and June, but you may not be picking it up because the numbers are small enough. But that would be where I would look on the undersides of leaves and see if anybody's present. The second time would be when you get the second generation in early August.
Okay.
But another thing you can consider, and this is kind of a home remedy type of treatment, but stink bugs overwinter as adults, and squash bugs.
Sure.
And so I've seen people take shingles and other things and throw them out in the garden. So, you know, normally we tell you get rid of all the debris so there's no place for the bugs to spend the winter in.
Yeah.
But here what they're doing is using it as a squash bug trap. And they put the couple shingles out there and the squash bugs crawl underneath it. And then in the spring you lift them up and you take care of the ones that are hiding there.
Okay.
So as I said, that might be worth trying because the more you shut the door early in the season, the better success you're going to have.
Yeah, that's great to me.
Thanks. All right. Thanks. Thanks a lot for calling. Dave emailed to ask for more information about snow midges. Is it possible for insects to hang out in the snow?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that came up the other day in the show.
You know, we have snow fleas, which are springtails. We have something called a winter stonefly. If you're next to streams, there's all kinds of interesting things that can come out of the streams and end up on the snow. There is also a winter crane fly, which is a real neat. It's a pretty big fly-like creature that comes out. So, yes, the term midge or gnat, honestly, is kind of a generic term. And it just means a little wing thing, and it could be a true midge, which is a fly, mm-hmm. but it could be something like a winter stonefly, which is a different group of insects. But as I said, more often than not, most I can think of are associated with moving water. And of course, the water doesn't freeze, so my insects can continue to develop. And then the adults come out, and you know, you think about it, there aren't a whole lot of predators in the winter, so it's not a bad time if you can become active to come out and do your thing.
Here's a... on Facebook, another interesting photo. Jeff from Greensville emailed it to us. He thought it was a rat mite. It's
sure.
a really cool...
So it is in the rat mite family, but I have a stronger suspicion it's a group that we find with birds. So if you were to send me this picture and say, boy, I'm getting bit and what's going on here, we find that these are parasitic mites on birds, but there are some found on rodents. Those tend to be more common in the southern states and California than we see rat mites up here. But so you have a bird nest, and when the birds are in there, they're picking on the birds and they're happy. When the birds leave, you know, and fledge, then they start to migrate. And so I wonder, in this case, he was talking, it was up in the hay up in the barn, is he potentially had some birds nesting there, and that's where the mites were coming from. So they're really quite seasonal, and the way to approach it is to get rid of the bird nest, if at all possible, because that's the source. And once that's removed, the mites will bite people, but don't believe what you read on the internet. Bird mites do not infest people for the rest of their life and invade their homes. It just doesn't work that way. So typically, you know, you clean the source. If you have to, again, you can spray soapy water, or even probably any indoor cleaner will kill them on contact. Or you vacuum them up, if at all possible, and things should go away. So I'm hoping it was just kind of a seasonal thing and you don't run into it again. But if you do, as I said, it's better to hunt down the source. The argument I've always used, the story in California is they've got pocket rats that nest under their crawl spaces. And these things are associated with the nests of those animals and then come into the person's living space. But we just don't have that kind of thing. I've never seen rodent populations high enough for me to suspect that we're going to have rodent mites causing problems for people in their living quarters.
And this photo is really a cool photo. It's almost like a gel, transparent gel.
So what
gel.
You're seeing here is the dark, is the intestinal. And you can tell this thing has not been eating recently because there isn't a whole lot of food in its gut. If it had recently fed on an animal, it would be full with red blood, you know, almost like a mosquito.
Oh.
And that's what's causing these things to migrate. They're getting hungry, and so they migrate out. And so typically when people see these, you know, I see the samples on a piece of tape because they're kind of hard to pick up and they're easy to squish. But if you put a piece of tape on them, you can pick them up and get a lot of complaints in June and July, and I've seen them even as late as September, but it's a very seasonal, warm season kind of problem because that's when the birds are raising young and that's when the mites are active.
Scott and Merrimack, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello there. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
We were up at our cabin in Memorial Day, and we seen a worm, long, thin, looked like corn silk. I got a hold of the UW, and they said it was a horsehair worm and a parasite of a grasshopper.
Right.
Just how common are they?
More common than people think, but typically you only see them active out in you know, the space you can see them after a heavy rain. And the other thing is that they spend most of their time internally as a parasite of grasshoppers and other insects. So one of these things has to come out. But, you know, as you described, the things can be 4 or 5 inches long, but extremely thin. Yep. And it used to be believed that if you drop a horsehair into a bucket of water, it could develop into a worm. Well, you know, biology doesn't work that way. But if a cricket or grasshopper fell into that water, these things would emerge. And to be honest, as far as I'm aware of, they do have water requirements in their immature stages. So they are associated with very wet conditions, typically. And as I said, where I would get most of the calls is after a heavy rain, somebody would walk out and see this funny thing just kind of wiggling and whatnot on the on the top of their mulch or elsewhere, and that's what gets their attention. You know, and again, if you don't identify them properly, you might think that they're human parasites or whatnot, but they're not. They're basically insect parasites, and the common name is horsehair worm for them.
Yeah, it was on a plastic flower, and when I touched it, it reacted. That's why I believed it was something real.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an amazing creature, and as I said, it's a very unique thing, but, you know, it's something you could go another 10 years looking for them and not see one. But if you collect a whole bunch of grasshoppers and, you know, whatnot, it wouldn't be surprising to see some of these things come out. I think they're more common.
We can watch it anytime.
Yeah, right. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Scott. Appreciate it. We had Russ and Stoughton email in and wanting to know how to encourage more bees and butterflies and needed insects and bugs to his yard.
Diversity is kind of, you know, the problem if you live in the city is that everybody's lawn is the same and it isn't very diverse. What we find with why we've got declining bee populations and butterfly populations is either the plants or the habitat that they require to go through their life cycles doesn't exist. So having old woodlots full of dead trees and things, having prairie areas and diverse areas, even having bare soil areas, are creating little environments that these things can raise themselves. So, as I said, the more you can do for diversity. Now, in the case of butterflies, a lot of times all you're doing is attracting the adults that are coming in. You know, that, you know, if you're going to raise, you know, black swallowtails, then you'd have to grow some parsley. If you're raising monarchs, you'd have to have some milkweed and the like. So if you know what the individual critter you want to promote likes, you might be able to plant the plants. But for so much of this stuff, or if you're talking this broader scale, as I said, the more diversity you have in your neighborhood, the more diverse environments, the more kind of critters that are going to develop there.
That's pretty cool. And Carrie in Whitewater wondered about scale insects on a bay tree.
Okay. Scales are a real challenge because they have at least two parts of their life cycle you can't control them, in the egg stage, in the adult stage, when they're covered under that protective coat. Now, there are some systemic chemicals that you can put in the soil, and they kind of give you a false sense, because what the systemics do is move through the plant sap, and as the baby scales feed on it, it kills them. But what you find is that in a bigger tree, you're not moving chemical to all the spots you need, and especially on the older tissue. So all of a sudden, they start to come back. So insecticidal soap at a two-week interval would be a way of really getting after them. And then if you want to add the systemic as an added benefit, that would be a possibility.
Always a pleasure, Phil. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good, Larry.
Keep working on that book, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
yep. Your wife's probably talking to you about that as well.
Well, she's really been pretty good and very supportive. But, yes, Phil needs to be more disciplined.
Tomorrow we'll talk about data privacy, robocalls, and other consumer protection issues. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.